All right, good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining me today. This is the monthly meeting of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. My name is Janice Bellucci, and I'm the executive director. I'm also an attorney here in California. So we have a lot of topics to cover today, including some new topics. And we've got good news to share. I always love to share good news. So other people will be joining us here in just a minute as we speak. So why don't I just talk real briefly about compliance checks? Law enforcement, conduct compliance checks all over the nation, and all over the nation, I want you to know the answer is the same. Despite what law enforcement and others might tell you, you do have constitutional rights while you're on the registry, and even you're on parole and probation. And the reason I'm telling you that is that when somebody comes to your home for a compliance check, they have to follow the rules. Okay, you need to follow the rules, but so do they. So let's talk first about people on parole and probation. If law enforcement comes to your front door and they ask you, this is a compliance check. We want to make sure that you actually live at this address. And you go, that's great. Thank you so much, sir, ma'am, whatever. Be polite. Okay. And in fact, if you're on parole or you're on probation or supervised release for the federal government registrants, the fact is you have to let them in your house and they can conduct a search inside your house, but only if you're on parole, probation, or supervised release. If you're not on one of those three things, also some people just refer to it as being on paper, then guess what? They cannot come into your house without a search warrant, okay, in general. And the Fourth Amendment protects you and every person in the United States here from what's considered an unreasonable search. So if they come to your house and they think that this is, sorry, I'm gonna stop somebody's video there because it's distracting. If they come to your house and it's a compliance check, the only thing you really have to tell them is kind of your name, rank, and serial number. So yes, my name, and yes, I live here. And if they start asking you other questions, you don't have to answer those questions. In fact, I mean, the bottom line is you don't even have to answer the door. And I'm telling you this in all sincerity. Again, if you're not on parole, you're not on probation, and you're not on supervised release, you don't have to answer the door. Now, you may choose to answer the door because why? They show up sometimes with all their wearing their all their costume, right? So sometimes they show up looking like SWAT team, all kinds of things. And especially if you're living in a multifamily situation, you may not want all your neighbors seeing a SWAT team in front of your door. Okay, so if something like that should happen, you might choose to go to the front. But when you go to the front door, be very careful. All right, because the thing is, when you open your front door, the police can look inside your home, and if they see something that they think is evidence of a crime, then guess what? They just, then all of a sudden they have probable cause and they can enter your home even though they don't have a search warrant. And what might that be? I don't know, something like a hunting knife. Heaven forbid you have a gun, and it might be a BB gun, but they see a gun. You're not supposed to have a gun because you're on the registry. Then, in fact, they have probable cause to enter your home. So, Janice's best advice is this: if they knock on your front door, answer, and you want to talk to them. Again, they might be dressed in SWAT team uniforms or whatever. Go to the front door, step out of your front door, and close the front door behind you because then they can't see into your home, right? And I swear, even if you lock yourself out, you'll be able to find a way to get back in your home, right? And you do not want law enforcement looking inside of your home because, in fact, they might see something that they interpret as probable cause. So let's just eliminate that nonsense, eliminate the search by either not answering the door at all, or if you do choose to answer the door, you walk outside your front door and you close the door behind you so they can't see inside your house. So, do I have any questions? Anybody have a question this morning about compliance checks? I don't see any hands up right now, but I will tell you that because people ask me from time to time, why are they doing compliance checks, including people who've lived in the same home for a very long period of time? Well, quite frankly, I'm a bit of a mercenary here, and I think they're mercenaries because I think the only reason most of these compliance checks take place is because, in fact, they've gotten a government grant to do it. And so the people who are conducting the checks often are being paid overtime. And, quite frankly, they don't really care, right? They don't care about what they're doing. Many times, if you're not home or you don't answer the door, they'll leave a card behind or something like that and say, hey, would you give us a call just to confirm you live at that address? I'm just telling you, too, it's not the end of the world if, in fact, you're not there and you don't answer the door. Most of the time, they will leave a card. Raphael, you've got your hand up, sir. answer.
Yes, thank you. So when they were here the last time at my house, I did what you said, but they were looking through my windows. Now, can they then see something through the windows that they might consider to be, bad?
It's possible,
And can
sure.
I stop them from doing that? Can I say, don't look through my windows? Don't go around my house?
I think the only thing you can do is close the curtains or the shades you might have on the window. Yeah. And I'm sorry to say that because you should have the right to let sunshine into your house, right? But on the other hand, and I'm not suggesting people live in the dark at most times. I'm basically suggesting if they knock on your door, you might want to pull the shades or the curtains. That's a good point. Thank you.
Now, the last thing is that they also asked me, are there any kids in the house? I don't know why they asked that, but I said no.
And Rafael, are you on parole or probation right now?
No.
Okay. Well, this is only a guess, but it's an educated guess. Right now, the cops, DAs, all of that part of the equation. Right now, everybody's like focused on child support, right? And it's like the buzzword. And all you have to do, I swear, these days is say child sex trafficking, and the next thing you know, you get a grant. Right, you get money from the government, so maybe that's why they're asking. When they get their money for doing the compliance check, maybe that's one of the requirements is to ask, are there any kids in the house? And you can just smile and say no. So,
Hi, Dennis.
all right, yes,
Can you hear me?
I can. Who are you?
Hi, my name's Mark.
Hi, Mark.
So I had a question. I'm not sure if I'm addressing the elephant in the room, so to speak, but the other people that are at our residence, I recently talked to a sheriff's deputy, and he told me that my wife relinquished her Fourth Amendment right when she married me. But I beg to differ. Choosing to be with someone doesn't forfeit her constitutional right in any way.
Well, and you have
And I,
constitutional rights yourself.
right. I mean, I have the constitutional rights to a lot of things, but like, for instance, we live on land and our cabin is in the center of our land. And so when they come out to the property, they really don't have any right to come on our property. Sorry about that.
Okay,
That
let
was a
me ask you.
motorcycle going by.
Okay, Mark, are you on parole, probation, or supervised release?
No.
Okay, then you're right. They don't have any right to be on your property. So unless, they see, there's always exceptions to every rule, folks. So let's just say if somebody came running toward your house with a gun in their hand, and it was smoking because they could tell that the shots have been fired. Well, something like that, then they could follow your house. But in the general rule is they cannot. So, I mean, I don't know what kind of protection you have. Do you have a fence around your home?
No, it's raw land, but I wouldn't recommend anyone running onto the property with a gun in their hand. So the other thing was, of course, again, he said something to the effect of when I mentioned to him that all of her constitutional rights are intact and she's never committed a crime, doesn't fall into any categories or anything like that. In fact, she's probably more qualified to have a concealed carry than most cops are.
Okay,
That's
let's
how
stop,
sweet and clean.
Mark, let's stop there. Okay, so you're crossing a line when you start talking about weapons. So let's just say, in general, because you're not on parole, probation, or supervised release, they have the right to come and knock on your door if they can find your door, I guess, but they do not have the right to come into your home. So,
Right.
and what
Well,
the and but your and your wife has the same rights. They come from the U.S. Constitution, folks, and we're talking about the Fourth Amendment that basically protects citizens, actually people who live here, you don't even have to be a citizen, protects us all from unreasonable searches and seizure. Okay, so you and your wife are protected. Let's just leave it at that and go on, okay? And if you want to
sure.
talk about guns or things like that, then save it for a private conversation because this conversation is being recorded.
Right. No, and I'm not in any way suggesting, because she's completely opposed to firearms or anything like that. But my point is that her rights are all intact. Meaning, I should not say that because so are mine. But the nothing in her freedom or her liberties or anything to do with her is compromised just because she lives with me.
I agree.
Because
So,
it doesn't forfeit none of her rights as a citizen.
Mark, I'm going to interrupt you. I agree with you, and we need to go on. But thank you for your comment there. Okay, so that's compliance checks, folks. And I will pass on one anecdote. It's nothing more than an anecdote, which is that Frank Lindsay, and I assume many of you know who he is because I've talked about him many years now, but Frank Lindsay lived in the same home. You know, he still lives in the same home. He's lived in this home for more than 30 years. And for a while there, every single year, his local police department was coming to his home. And he said, "Why are you here?" And he wasn't on parole, probation, or supervised release. And they basically said, "It's a compliance check, right?" And so I guess what I'm trying to say is it doesn't make sense. These compliance checks often don't make sense, but they are what they are. So if you can be polite with law enforcement, and try to either get them, get them away from your home as soon as you can, especially if you live in a multifamily environment, such as an apartment, a condo, even a townhouse. You know, you don't want your neighbors, I imagine, watching a bunch of law enforcement people standing in front of your door with guns, carrying guns. So anyway, that's just an assumption on my part. Okay, I know we've gotten quite a few other people who've joined us, and here comes another one. But I just want to remind you, this is the monthly meeting of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. It's Saturday, and the date is June, I'm sorry, August 17th. So thank you for being here today. That we have some new things to talk about today. And so I think I'm just going to skip to the new things, and then we'll come back to the topics that we normally discuss. One of the things I want to talk about is the decision this week that was issued by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. Okay, so the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled today, I'm sorry, this week, on a case that involved the state of North Carolina. And so the interesting thing is that the trial court had agreed with the registrants. Okay, the trial court agreed with the registrants that in fact they had an ex post facto protection, and so new laws could not be passed and applied retroactively. Unfortunately, that case was appealed to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals said disagreed with the trial court. Okay, and as far as I'm concerned, this is a terrible decision, and unfortunately, not unexpected. So, reason I'm bringing it up for many reasons. And so let's talk a little bit about the facts of the case. The plaintiffs in that case, were convicted long ago. New laws were passed by the state of North Carolina, and then those new laws were applied to these folks retroactively. So that's not supposed to happen. There is a clause in the U.S. Constitution against things like this happening if it's punishment. And as you all know, being on the registry in and of itself is punishment. And I say that boldly, regardless of the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court has made a prior inconsistent decision, right? So Smith versus Doe, which I talk about a lot, a U.S. Supreme Court decision from the year 2002, is a terrible decision. It was wrongly decided. It was based on myth, and we don't have a lisp there, MYTH, and not based on facts. So this case brought, basically challenged the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling, and I think it was a really foolish thing to do. And I want to ex take a minute to explain about Axol and how we have a different approach. I think we have the same ultimate goal as the organization that filed this lawsuit. And that ultimate goal for all of us is to get rid of the registry 100%. Get rid of it. It's like you're at the blackboard, you erase that chalk from the chalkboard. Okay. So, but the question is, how do you do it? How do you get rid of a U.S. Supreme Court decision that was wrong? And so there's more than one way, but one to do it right, but there's also some ways, the wrong ways to do it. And I think that this case was a wrong way to do it. If you think about it, it's almost like walking into helicopter blades, right? You know, those blades are whirring about above your head, but you stand up anyway, and guess what? Your head gets chopped off. So I think that's what really happened in this decision, and that's why I'm really upset about it. I'm upset that they took this case forward. They should never have taken this case forward. They should have never said the U.S. Supreme Court is wrong. And oh, by the way, Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, we want you to overrule your bosses on the U.S. Supreme Court. That's what they did. Okay. So what do I think is a better approach? I call it incrementalism. Okay. And for those of you who might have heard of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was quite an advocate of incrementalism. And so what I mean by that is instead of a full frontal attack, what we do is we're basically, taking bites out of the foundation of the registry. And so when we get laws, I'm sorry, when we are able to overturn laws, when we're able to get things like a tiered registry law here in California, that's ways that we are incrementally getting rid of the registry. And so the tiered registry law itself here in California, under the current law, which we are working hard to prove, but under the current law, 45% of the people on the California registry are eligible now or will be soon to petition for removal from the registry. I mean, think about it. We have over 100,000 people on a registry. If we can get rid of 45,000 people from the registry, that is fabulous, right? That's 45,000 people whose lives will be significantly improved. So that's how we're working at this. And I'm not quite sure any other analogy that you all might think of, you know, like how do you, but oh, here's another one. How about the American Revolutionary War, right? The British were here. They were wearing their red coats. I've read about this. Obviously, I wasn't there. They're wearing their red coats. They're marching in formation and stuff like that. Well, guess what? They were easy to shoot down because they were in formation. And I understand that, in fact, our forebears were in the woods shooting at them, right, to get rid of them. And we were kind of, it's kind of like guerrilla warfare, I guess, for lack of a better term. And I know there's a lot of people out there who are more educated about such things. But I think, you know, that's how I think of myself. I'm hiding in the woods, and there's the British redcoats marching in formation, and I'm going to pick them off, you know, one by one. And I don't condone violence. I'm actually, you know, a nonviolent person, and I and so it that's what it is. But when I think about what we're doing and everything, I would never take a frontal attack on Smith versus Doe because we'd lose, right? We would just lose unless we can convince John Roberts, who's the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, that he made a mistake back in the year 2022. So I'm sorry, 2002. So this is where we are, folks. And fortunately, you know, there are attorneys out there who will take cases who may not know the law very well. Actually, the attorney who took this case, his name was Paul Dubling. He knows the law very well. I don't know why he took this case. I think it was a mistake. So I haven't talked to Paul about it. Paul, if you're listening, that's how I feel. I'm not going to apologize. But the fact is, and it takes more time, by the way, to do things incrementally than to take and win a frontal attack. But you have to win. And so the problem is with decisions like what just came out of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals this week, it sets the rest of us back. Okay. But here's another decision that says, guess what? That being on the registry is not punishment. Ah, doesn't that make you crazy when you hear that? U.S. Supreme Court's telling you that the fact that you're on the registry is not punishment. And therefore, you know, new laws can be passed and applied retroactively. It's just one of those things that makes crazy. I see Ellie Miller, one of our board members, has just joined us. Hi, Ellie. Ellie, I just wondered Good if you morning. Might want to briefly talk about criminal law and kind of the concept of, you know, why are ex post facto laws bad? I guess is what I'm asking.
Oh, I have to go back to law school days, but, you know, the ex post facto rule, you know, can harm people who had no idea there was a law in place or was going to be a law in place in the future. And, you know, that's one issue the courts always, the appellate courts always look at, whether or not something should be retroactive. And it's just a toss up on, you know, how they feel about the law. Janice, I'm assuming you're talking about, or you talked about SB 1128, which is
not yet.
DOO, not, okay, sorry.
Yeah. No, but Ellie, just like you, in law school, we learned that this is the assumption, folks, with the law, that before you commit a crime, you think about what the consequences are, right? Like if I murder somebody, then, you know, it, depending on the state, even there's a possibility of a death penalty. So, or life without parole or something like that. I don't know that really happens to anybody before they commit a crime, but that's like a basic foundation of criminal law. So that's why when new criminal laws get passed and are applied retroactively, that's why it just is so offensive to me, I'm sure to Ellie as well, and other lawyers, because that's not supposed to happen. You know, what if all of a sudden a law was passed that said, you know, if you consume more than 10 grams of caffeine in a day, that's a crime. I don't know about you all, but I'd be in big trouble. I have 3 cups of coffee a day, and then I eat some chocolate, you know? Caffeine and I get along really well. We're good friends. So, and then, I mean, what if all of a sudden they applied that retroactively and I had to count how many cups of coffee that I had, you know, for all these years and stuff? I'd end up in prison for a long time because I was a serial caffeinator. I'm sorry, making this up as I go along, you can tell. So anyway, but I'm saying this, it's ridiculous, but that's, these laws are ridiculous. And a lot of courts are making ridiculous decisions. But the thing is, you know, when you go right after the U.S. Supreme Court and tell them that they've made a mistake and they need to correct it now, you better have a compelling argument. And it might not hurt to have different members of the court. somebody who you think might actually agree with you. So anyway, I just want to make sure that you all know about that. On the Axol website, we do have an article about it. Link to the article is the actual decision. It's not too long for an appellate decision. I think it's only 24 pages long, and that's pretty brief for an appellate court. And you might actually want to read it. And then, you know, you can shake your head too and going, what were they thinking? So do we have any questions about the North Carolina laws or this appellate court decision before I go on? Because I want to talk about some good news, and Ellie just brought it up. So here in California, we had a sin. Oh, David, you have your hand up.
Yes. As I was thinking about this, perhaps the attorney Paul, who knows the law, is wanting to also appeal this to the Supreme Court and further inform them that this is not, I mean, that this is in fact punishment.
Well, it's possible, but these days the Supreme Court doesn't grant review to most cases. I mean, I think it's like down to 3% or something like that. It's an expensive price to pay to try to knock on that door. So there's different ways to get to this U.S. Supreme Court. Having a difference of opinion in the circuit courts of appeal is one way, but I don't know that there's a circuit court of appeal that disagrees with this decision. That's the problem. You have to have disagreements.
Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome.
If I could add, David, the Supreme Courts, even in California and also the U.S. Supreme Court, take up issues that are right when there seems to be a split among courts in regard to the issue. And my feeling is that this issue isn't ripe. And the last thing we want is bad law. So if I were Paul, I would look at the current makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court and cut my losses.
In other words, not ask the Supreme Court even for review. Is that what you're saying, Ellie?
Correct. Yeah. Because if they granted it, which I'm like Janice, I don't believe they would grant it. But the last thing appellate attorneys want to do is make bad law. And this would be making bad law, is in my opinion.
And Ellie and I agree on that. Thank you, Ellie, for your opinion. Okay. So let's talk about some good news. Senate Bill 1128 was introduced here in California. And in some respects, it seemed innocuous until finally somebody explained the impact of this bill, which, get this, it would have added up to 32,000 people onto the California registry in one fell swoop. And that just chilled my blood. And the minute I found out about it, I started, you know, sending alerts to the board members of Axol, putting information on our website saying we got to stop this bill. So what it was all about was changing language in the tiered registry law that basically would make a category of individuals required to register who have never registered. And by the way, some of these people were convicted like 40 years ago. And so for 40 years, they never registered. And all of a sudden, they're going to have to register. I mean, talk about ex post, though, right? So, and you know, in most cases, people enter into plea agreements. And so if you enter into a plea agreement and registration is not required, and then 40 years later, all of a sudden registration is required, does that kind of start smelling like punishment? I think so. But anyway, the good news is we were able to stop Senate Bill 1128. And it happened almost last minute, definitely in the 11th hour of the process, the legislative process. And it just happened this past Thursday, so which would have been the 15th. So there's so many lessons to be learned about this. One of the lessons is Ellie and myself and eight other board members went to a hearing here in Sacramento on July 2nd. And at that hearing on July 2nd, the Public Safety Committee passed the bill. So it's very discouraging. I mean, Ellie flew from Los Angeles, LAX, and a lot of other people did as well from all over the state to come to this hearing on July 2nd. And by the way, we weren't the only people opposing, or the only organization opposing the legislation, but having 10 board members come, and by the way, on fairly short notice, was remarkable. And it was also disheartening and maybe even discouraging, Ellie. Please you add on in just a minute, to have the committee pass the bill, even though we sent in a formal letter, phone calls were made to the members of that committee saying, no, 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 don't pass this bill. Ellie, do you want to talk about your experience there on July 2nd? Ellie, you're muted.
I was glad that I attended. And it was somewhat disheartening when the proponents of the bill went first. And they had the Los Angeles city attorney who only prosecutes misdemeanors. So more likely than not, she would have never prosecuted that type of charge, which probably would be filed as a felony. And there was a LAPD officer who is probably being considered for the next LAPD police chief. They had victims of this crime. And having been a public defender in LA County for a number of years, I know what this law is, and it is consensual sex, but it's consensual sex between a minor and an adult. And the reason it comes to the attention of prosecutors is because usually the minor is a female and her parents find out either because 9 months after the intercourse, she gets pregnant and has a baby and nobody ever knew, and they're pissed off. It's just not a crime that should be a registrable offense. There are other crimes that can be used. And I think as somebody said, Janice said previously, California was one of four states that did not make this offense a registrable offense. So we were ready to take the court, where the legislature was ready to take a step backward. But when we were able to get up and oppose that particular bill, I thought it was very powerful. And I was just glad to be a part of it. So
thank you, Ellie. Yeah, it was wonderful to have you there. I live in the Sacramento area, so I didn't have to travel far as Ellie did, and most of the 10 board members did as well. But this is the kind of thing. So here they're traveling far. They're taking the entire day off of work and everything to be at this hearing, and only to have that committee, it was a public safety committee, pass the bill that day on July 2nd. But this week on August 15th, the Appropriations Committee was considering the same bill. And in between that, I was able to join several meetings with the author of the bill and his staff that assigned to the bill. And his last name is Portantino. And the reason I was allowed to join these meetings was because of our new lobbyist. So Axel now has an official lobbyist. It's the first time in our existence we've had a professional paid lobbyist. We are paying. You hear that? We are paying a lobbyist here in Sacramento to help us through this process. And I mean, he proved his value certainly on Senate Bill 1128, because one of the things he said was, don't compromise, because we were ready to compromise, right? We wanted to make sure this bill was not going to be applied retroactively. And so I said, you know, if push came to shove, if we had to have this bill passed, at least the language should say and guarantee that it wasn't going to be applied retroactively in order to prevent 32,000 people being added to the registry. And his good, wise counsel was, not yet, not yet. A compromise might be necessary, but don't compromise yet. And he was absolutely right. So in the Appropriation Committee, and by the way, that committee deals with money, right? Money. And the fact is that they thought that it would cost a lot of money, the state government, it would cost them a lot of money if they added 32,000 people to the register. So appropriations is, you never know where they're going to come down. But the fact is too, you know, it was noted that there was a lot of opposition to the bill. So I know, you know, Ellie and I and 8 other board members were at the hearing, but we had a heck of a lot more people who made phone calls to the 7 members of the committee, who sent letters to the members of the committee, et cetera. And that also made difference. So for those of you folks who are not in California, I want you to say this is a lesson you can apply to each and every state and each and every legislature, that sometimes there is a setback. Sometimes you will experience a setback, but don't give up. Okay, what if we had given up at that time and just said, well, okay, you know, the Public Safety Committee approved the bill, and therefore we've lost. No. It's like, okay, we had the Appropriations Committee, and then it was going to go to the Assembly floor and the last thing governor's office. And, you know, we were doing our best to prepare for all those possibilities. But the earlier that you can kill a bill, the better off it is. So it was fabulous news this Thursday that, in fact, the Appropriation Committee stopped the Senate Bill 1128. For all of those you in other states, please get involved in your legislative process there and with your organizations in your home state, because you can and will be there. So does anybody have any questions about 1128 before we go on? Okay. All right. So let's go on. Let's go on and talk about another success. We filed, so we're challenging Halloween signs right now. And, you know, why are we doing this? Because quite frankly, frankly, it's low-hanging fruit. We have cases on our side that say any government organization that requires a registrant to put a sign on their phone on Halloween, or as the case was in Arkansas, for 2 weeks, 1 week before Halloween, Halloween, and a week after, that in fact that's compelled speech and therefore a violation of First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. So we filed cases actually first in Missouri and then in Arkansas, and we're looking to file a case in Texas if we can find a plaintiff in the right city there in Texas. Still looking. Anybody knows a friend in Texas who's required to register, please let us know. Okay, so Missouri, we went to trial in June. We filed a post-trial briefs in July, and it's August, and we don't have a decision yet. So it can be frustrating as we kind of twiddle our thumbs here waiting for the judge to issue a decision. By the way, the judge doesn't have a deadline for issuing a decision. So my assistant and I, we have different opinions. I think it's quite possible that the judge will issue the decision during Labor Day weekend. Why is that, right? Because judges like to issue unpopular decisions during the holiday weekends because media is not paying attention, right? And like, ho-hum, they'll probably miss it entirely. And if they're not, nobody will read it in the newspaper anyway. So that's my best guess. My assistant's best guess, he thinks the judge is going to wait until after Halloween. Why is that? That would be a safe decision for him to make, because there's a temporary restraining order already in place in this case. Okay. So nobody in the state of Missouri can in fact require their registrants to post a sign on the front door of their house on Halloween. Nobody. Okay. In Missouri, they're not supposed to anyway, if they do, they're breaking the law and we can take them to court. Okay. So anyway, and we also know, and the judge knows, that the Attorney General of Missouri is in fact going to appeal his decision. So I'm sure no matter when he issues the decision, he will spend a lot of time writing it and dotting all those I's and crossing all those T's. And then the question is, when does he want to basically answer to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals? So I don't know the answer to that question, but I want you to know that the judge has in fact been leaning in our direction and support of our position since day one. So he's been a good judge that way. Even at trial, he let it be known that he thought we had a reasonable position, and he really gave the Attorney General every opportunity to prove us wrong. And I don't think the Attorney General has met that burden. So I'm expecting good news from Missouri, the federal district court judge. I just don't know when it's going to happen. So does anybody want to say anything about this? About Missouri?
I have a question. Sure. Did President Biden appoint that Attorney General only because there's an election coming up? And
no.
Usually,
this AG is not a federal AG. He's a state AG.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I will say, in his brief, he said things that I cannot imagine anybody would ever say to a federal district court judge. And this is one of them. We're the state of Missouri, and we don't have to do what the federal government tells us to do. I mean, that was in writing in one of his briefs. And I'm like, oh my goodness. And then I did a little bit of research, and I found out the state of Missouri was part of the Confederacy. But folks, that was a long time ago, and they did lose the Confederacy. So maybe he hasn't gotten the memo yet. I don't know, but it was one of the strangest things I've ever written in a legal brief. And of all things, I mean, you might have that personal opinion, but I think if you did, you'd keep it to yourself. You wouldn't be saying that to a federal judge, but we shall see. Okay. So then there's Arkansas. Actually, we didn't file a lawsuit against the state of Arkansas, but we filed a lawsuit against a county in the state of Arkansas, because the state does not have a law that requires registrants to put a sign on the front door. They don't, or anywhere. Instead, in Marion County, Arkansas, they do, or they did. And so it was really, it was really a head scratcher. And when we first found out about this, because somebody called, who, by the way, had the sign put on his front door by his registration officer. Can you imagine that? The registration officer came to his home with a pre-made sign and put it on his front door and said, yeah, Halloween will be here in about a week, and don't take it down. And, I'll take it down. I'll be here about a week after Halloween. And fortunately, guess what? This registrant knew about compelled speech and said, no, you can't do that. And went on to quote the First Amendment. And guess what the deputy sheriff said to him? If you don't like it, sue me. He really said those words, right? And so guess what? He called us and we sued them. So we filed the lawsuit in this case, but we didn't go very far in the case because the very first meeting we had with the judge asked the attorney representing the county about the sign. And this attorney said, oh, the registrant agreed to have the sign put on his front door. And it was really humorous. I mean, judges don't normally do this. He was pretty folksy, though. He goes, the judge, so let me get this right. A deputy sheriff shows up with this badge on his jacket and with a gun on his hip in a holster and puts the sign on the front door, and you think that's voluntary? So anyway, shortly after that happened, the county said, please don't go to any more work because we know we're going to have to pay you attorney's fees and costs. This is to the organization, not to me. And sure enough, we settled the case. So thank you, Marion County, Arkansas. Now, we know there's at least one other county in Arkansas who has a similar requirement, and we're waiting to see what happens this Halloween. I don't have anybody from that county. And by the way, if you have a person you know in Faulkner County, Arkansas, like the William Faulkner, the author, please let me know because they have the same requirement. And by the way, we did do a little bit of discovery in the case. And what we found out was a whole bunch of sheriffs got together, the sheriffs, you know, in Arkansas, and they basically thought this was a good idea. They knew there was no state law that required this, but they just thought that they would just claim that they had the authority to do it anyway. And at least one county sheriff now knows better. So that's in Marion County, Arkansas. So, you know, we have to do these things. And Texas, we've heard that down in the Rio Grande Valley, which is a very southern tip of the state, that a few cities down there have Halloween sign requirements. And I'm serious, if you know somebody who lives down there and is required to register, please have them contact me because we do want to file a lawsuit there as well. We want to stop these Halloween sign requirements because, folks, I mean, I'm sure if you think about it, the fact is if you have to put a sign on your front door or anywhere in your house, it basically says, I am a sex offender, right? And even if you have to put the sign up only for one day of the year, your neighbors are not going to forget that sign, right? And they might harm you. They might, I don't know, dump your garbage. They might egg your house, whatever they might do. You know, it's just ridiculous. All right. So, yeah. I like JB says the Missouri state slogan is actually known as the Show Me State. So yeah, we showed. It was illegal. Or we're showing them. Okay, so let's go on past the Halloween. I want to talk about overseas travel next. And I talked a little bit about it last month, but I've done some more research and I wanted to share the research that I found about this. So up to this point in time, we have told you, because it's true, that you could go to Europe and go to one of these countries that are in the Schengen consortium, some group called Schengen. Okay, but it looks like that might be changing, but we're not sure when it's going to change or how it's going to change. And I still don't have precise information, but I have more information as compared to last month. So let's start out with, this is called the European Travel Information and Authorization System. And folks, if you're not talking, would you please mute yourself? We're hearing somebody cough here. ETIAS. Okay. So the ETIAS system, and it's been talked about for a long time, and they've kept delaying. I mean, it's been delayed for years. Now, supposedly, this system is going into effect in spring of next year. Okay. So in spring of next year, something's changing in Europe. We don't know precisely what it is. Okay. But something is changing, and you would have to get this authorization before you could enter a country, a Schengen nation. By the way, it's not the same thing as a visa. So don't go to your consulate here in the United States and say, I want to get an ETIAS. For one thing, it's not available anywhere. And the other thing is, it's something that you'll have to go directly to ETIAS once it's in effect. Okay. So reason I'm bringing this to your attention is it's saying that when somebody applies for this authorization, you have to reveal if you've ever been convicted of a serious criminal offense. Pretty vague language, right? What is a serious criminal offense? And then they've listed a few categories of what they consider to be serious criminal offense. One of them is terrorism. All right. Another one is sexual exploitation of children. Quite frankly, that's the one that bothers me the most. Next one, trafficking of human beings. Next, trafficking of drugs. Next, murder. And the last one is rape. Okay. So I don't know about the definitions. Remember, the system hasn't been in effect yet. There's no guidelines yet that will describe what sexual exploitation of children means. If, I'm concerned that that could mean any offense involving a minor. And unfortunately, most of the people on the registry, at least in California, and I think nationwide, have their offense does involve a minor. So it remains to be seen how this is going to affect the ability of somebody on the registry to travel to a European nation. If I were you and you could travel to Europe somewhere the rest of this calendar year, I'd say go, go, go. Just go now. Don't wait. Just go now. Because right now, those nations will allow you to come and visit, okay, without any reservation. I laugh sometimes and say, yeah, Italy is one of the 26 nations of Schengen. So if you go to Italy, they'll greet you with a bottle of red wine and some pasta. That's a joke. If I were there personally, I would, but I'm not there personally. I don't live in Italy. So not yet anyway. So the fact is that just be careful. And as I said, if you have the ability to travel to a European nation this calendar year, I highly recommend that you so. If you're on supervised release or on parole or probation, it's going to be really difficult, if not impossible, for you to do that. But for the others of you who are not on parole, probation, or supervised release, and you have the ability to go to a European nation this year, I highly recommend it. Now, is it possible that the effective date of ETIAS will change? Yes, it is. Right now, I mean, not only are they not telling us a month, they're not telling us the date. No, I say, okay, on April 15th, this is going to go into effect. The latest I can find online is spring of 2025. So summer doesn't start until June. So maybe May, I don't know. And I think it's unknowable. And so I'm sure that there's some clashes going on here because at this point in time, Schengen, people living in one Schengen nation can travel to another one with, without any extra paperwork. I think it's going to apply to them as well, but it's certainly going to apply to Americans who want to go to a Schengen. And the four large Schengen countries are Italy, France, Germany, and Spain. And then there's 22 smaller ones. We have a list of the Schengen nation on the Axel website. If you want me to send you the list, I will send it to you if you send me an email requesting it. So again, if in fact you can go to Europe this sometime during the rest of the calendar year, I think it'll be clear sailing. If you wait till next year, I don't know. And again, I don't know when this is going to go into effect. When I read about this too, I think it's so curious because you're going to be applying online, whoever is going to apply online, and then they say that your authorization is going to come and it's going to somehow be on your passport that you've got this ETIAS authorization. I'm like, that's kind of creepy. What do I know? So anyway, somehow it's going to be added to our passport. There is going to be a fee involved. I think the last thing that I read, it says 7 euros, which I don't even know how many dollars, less than $10 these days, and stuff. So it's not a matter of the fee. I don't think anybody, if you have the money to go to Europe, less than $10 is not going to make a difference, I would imagine. But the problem is that they might not allow you to come in. Now, one of the other things that it says, and this is new information, it basically says if you apply for this authorization and you're denied, it says the other option is to apply for a visa. So you can, in fact, apply for a visa even if you get denied under ETIAS. And by the way, too, those offenses, those categories of offenses that I mentioned, it's supposed to be only during the last 10 years, okay? Supposedly, with one exception, and terrorism is supposed to be for 20 years. So let me read the categories again. I'm not going to mention terrorism. That's 20 years. The 10-year categories are sexual exploitation of children, trafficking of human beings, trafficking of drugs, murder, and rape. And Ellie, I don't know about you, but I even balk at rape because I think about statutory rape, right? Are they going to, in fact, include statutory rape in this? And we just don't know.
Well, the statutory rape is that 261.5, and it should be termed consensual sex with a minor.
Right.
So I think there's a trend in California to get away from calling it
Right.
statutory rape
Okay.
because it's that's such an inaccurate term for that particular law.
Right. Yeah, thank you. And folks, just so you know, and Ellie, I know earlier you mentioned this in passing, and I just want to explain something about statutory rape. Okay, so when you are less than 18 years old in California, and actually in California, and you have sex with somebody, well, sex with anybody, the thing is, you lack capacity. You lack legal capacity. It's just like, believe it or not, similar to contracts. If you are entering into a contract in California and you're less and 18 years old, you lack capacity to sign the contract with some exceptions, right? So let's just say, you're 17 years old, you go and buy a Maserati and, on the credit plan, who does that? But anyway, and then you wreck the Maserati. Well, guess what? The car company is out of luck. And that's why they're not going to sell you Maserati, by the way, without having somebody co-sign, because you lack legal capacity to enter into a contract. Well, unfortunately, it's the same darn thing when it comes to sex. So do we know that teenagers are sexually active? Of course we do. So does this make sense? No, it doesn't, but that's what the law says. So sorry about that. Okay, so does anybody have any questions about travel overseas before I move on? Jay Lee, you've got your hand. You have a question or comment? Jay Lee, can you hear us? Me? Please unmute yourself. You're still muted, Jay Lee. Okay, we can see an image, but we can't hear you, Jay Lee. Okay, well, maybe Jay Lee will come and join us later. Okay, so sometimes people do that by accident. Somebody loved my example of Maseratis, huh? Thank you, Dave. Oh, Tim's got his hand up. Yes, Tim.
Yes, my family for the last 20 years is in Vietnam, and I am on supervised release, and I have about a year left to go. I'm trying to get early term, but that's almost impossible in the state of Hawaii. Now, I was wondering if any restrictions that I don't know about in the country of Vietnam for allowing former or ex-sex offenders entry.
Yes, and chances are you will not be allowed to enter the country. So, Asia, all of Asia is off limits to people on the registry. So I talk about Europe because that's been the good news. The bad news is Asia. And the only place I know that has allowed registrants to enter in the past is Hong Kong. So maybe you can meet your loved one in Hong Kong. Yeah, but and by the way, we used to have somebody who was part of our community who used to follow this on a regular basis. He's not a lawyer. I'm very unhappy to say that he's back in custody, unfortunately, for possessing child pornography. So he's no longer doing that, and we don't have anybody who is following reliably what countries can be entered. Now, Tim, I know of somebody in the Philippines. He was married to a woman who was a citizen of the Philippines. He was able to hire an attorney in the Philippines who was able to get the necessary paperwork together so they could prove that he was married to a Filipino. Maybe you could do something similar in Vietnam, but I don't have any good news to share with you. Sorry.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome. Jay Lee, Mark's good hand up.
Thank
Oh,
you.
let's let Jay Lee, yeah, let's let Jay Lee speak, because I know Jay Lee, you've been coming and going. I think you're having a problem with your connection.
Can you hear me?
Jay Lee, yes, whoever that is.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, please ask your question or make your comment.
So when traveling outside of the country, how do you go about, do you just apply for the different countries, like through the United States consulate, before you go? Like, how do you even determine what countries are eligible for, your particular, offense?
Well, it depends on the country. Some countries require visas. Most countries require passports these days. So make sure you have a passport, a valid passport. And are you on the registry, or is your loved one?
My loved one is, yeah,
Yeah.
and it's not for a violent sex offense or anything like that. Nothing considered rape, but he's a three tier in California. So,
Well, okay, so violence is not the determining factor.
right.
It's whether or not his offense involved a minor. That means under 18. It's a federal definition, not any state definition. And the other thing, if he's required to register in any state. So if those two things are true, then he needs to notify law enforcement, basically the office where he registers, at least 21 days before he departs, goes overseas.
So it wasn't with a minor.
Okay. Well, that's great.
And yeah,
Then the
and then
other
he
thing.
was, but he does, have to register.
Okay. Well,
So
hold on, Jaylee. Let me answer your question, please, before you go on. Okay. Then, if there's another follow-up question, you can ask it. So, folks, everybody who's listening, listening to this today or on the recording, if your offense did not involve a minor, then the international Megan's Law doesn't apply to you. But be very careful with that. If you, it doesn't require physical contact. So unfortunately, if you were convicted of an offense that involved like child possession of child pornography, yes, I can say that, then in fact, that is considered an offense involving a minor. So don't answer. You don't need to tell me about your loved one and whether or not his offense did, because a lot of other people are listening to this, Jaylee, and I want them to hear that answer. Okay. Now, do you have a follow-up question?
So only if the crime involves a child, a minor, is what you're saying, is when you need to notify authorities.
Yes.
Otherwise, authorities in our country, as well as others, don't need to be notified, correct?
Your loved one does not have to notify them, but our country will notify the country to which he's traveled. So think about it. How crazy is that?
But it's very crazy. Yeah.
Okay. So our U.S. government is using lots of resources to review the manifest of every overseas flight that starts in the United States. If they find somebody on the manifest who is currently required to register, and this is not involving a minor, everybody who's required to register, they will send a notice to the country to which he is traveling. And the notice says, basically, paraphrasing, this person has been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. Well, in your case, you said it wasn't involving a minor. Well, then it probably would just say this person was convicted of a sex offense.
And also, real quick, does this apply to cruise ships as well?
It can. It's not 100% one way or the other. So before you buy a ticket on a cruise ship, make sure you talk to them about whether or not someone who's required to register can actually go on their ship. Because I'm also aware that there are cruise ships that do not allow registrants. They don't necessarily tell you ahead of time. And early on, I was contacted by somebody who had bought, you know, ticket for himself and his wife, and they were going to go on this great cruise, and, you know, how these, you know, they had to fly there to board the ship and all these excursions once they were on the ship. And he got notice about 10 days ahead of time that they were not going to allow him to get aboard the ship. And they said in writing, to their detriment, and we're doing this because we found out you're on the sex offender registry. And so, and then they said, we're not going to refund you any of your money. So guess what? I was able to get him a full refund for his cruise ship, for his flight and everything, but he was not able to get on the ship. So it's really important that you talk to the cruise line before you buy your ticket.
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much. I appreciate you answering my questions.
Absolutely. That's why I'm here.
Okay, thank you.
Mark, you're welcome. Mark, you have your hand up?
Oh, hi. Mark, off the registry, you said at one point that they stated, those who give those notifications stated, as far as they're concerned, they can give them even if people are off the registry. Do you have any new information on people, on them doing that or not doing that, sending notices for foreign travel when somebody is no longer on the registry? That's it. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Mark, for your question. So I don't have any new information about that, except for a possibility here, which is a very dark possibility. So a person who used to register in the United States, I moved out of the country about 3 years ago. And he's a U.S. citizen, so he had a U.S. passport. And a letter was sent to him by the U.S. State Department telling him that his U.S. passport had been revoked. And it was revoked because it didn't have a, quote, unique identifier in it. Okay. Well, and it said in the letter from the State Department that he was a, quote, covered sex offender under international Megan's Law. And I have written a very sharply worded letter to the Department of State. It was just a couple days ago. I don't have a reply. That said, you're wrong. He's not a covered sex offender because guess what? He's not required to register in any state. So I'm waiting for their response. And by the way, they sent a letter to an address where he had lived more than 20 years ago. Okay. Happened to be in the state of Florida. And when I saw that, I was horrified because if you register in Florida, they don't take you off the registry. That's the general rule. Always exceptions, folks, but they don't take you off the registry. He assured me that when he lived in Florida more than 20 years ago, he had not yet been convicted of a sex offense, and he's never registered in the state of Florida. So that was a relief. All right. But still, I think that that the federal government has made a big mistake here. I had a similar situation probably about 5 years ago. And in that case, I was able to persuade the State Department that they'd made a mistake. And they actually issued him a new passport at no cost, but you can imagine a lot of anxiety. So again, we've got a U.S. citizen right now who's living overseas and he doesn't have a current passport. That's not right. But because when I said there's possible, like there's this dark shadow over what's going on, I'm hoping that the Department of State is not saying that anybody who's ever been required to register is covered by the International Migrants Law. Okay. I'm hoping and praying that is not the position. I don't know yet if that's going to be their position. But trust me, Mark, and everybody else listening to this, once I find out that answer, I will let you know as soon as possible. And by the way, if that is their position in this gentleman's case, we will be filing a lawsuit very quickly because that's just wrong. Okay. He was previously required to register, actually in two states, but in both of those states, when you leave the state, they take you off the registry. And he's properly, thank goodness, went to his registration office and said, not only am I leaving the state, I'm leaving the country. And he's got the paperwork so I can prove it. So he did everything that he was supposed to do. And now still they revoked the passport. And by the way, the State Department is pointing the finger at the Department of Homeland Security in general, Angel Watch program, saying, oh, well, Angel Watch told us he was a covered sex offender. So stay tuned. This is going to be interesting no matter what happens. JP, you have your hand up.
I'm going to verbalize this based on what you said, and I know it's still foggy, but okay. somebody's on parole and yeah. It deals with a minor. I mean, they're off of parole now. Deal with the minor. Under 10 years, they getting a unique identifier, going through the whole process, once the Shaken Nations are off the table, it's almost not worth doing it. And if it's past 10 years, like you said, they were going to make it, if you think about it, you have to now, with just within the last recent years, you have a unique identifier, you have to contact the Department of State, and you have to do paperwork through the ETIS or whatever. Am I correct on that?
Well, it's the ETIS system is not in effect yet, but once it is, then yes, I agree. Yeah. And I can understand your position that maybe it's not worthwhile trying to get a passport and travel. So somebody just asked, what is ETIAS? Carl, we were talking about that, I think, before you joined us. ETIS is an acronym that stands for the European Travel Information and Authorization System. I'm not going to repeat what I said earlier. You'll just have to go back and listen to the recording. But anyway, it's something that might limit travel for people on the registry when they visit Europe. Okay. Charles, you have your hand up. Charles?
Yeah, I'm here. Louisiana just passed a bill saying that chemical castration can be done for sex offenders. And not only do I think that's really extreme, but I looked at other states that can do that. And of all states, California is able to do that. I think there's like six other states. I mean, but I think, isn't that like a punishment, like going back to like slave days to do that?
Let's see, Charles. Let me just stop here. So let's see. Anybody on this call thinks that castration is punishment? I think we would all say that it's punishment, right? And this is how and why it's such a clear example, Charles, of punishment that it's not even funny. I mean, it's terrible.
No, it's not. I mean, Isn't that kind of like mutilation? And I mean, I don't know. I just think it's like just, I mean, I knew they did that to slaves. I mean, that's 200 something years ago. And I don't know. I just think that immoral. And I don't know. Is there some sort of lawsuit or something that can challenge this?
I know of this. And I think there's another state, too, that passed actually surgical castration, a law. And so, sorry, I'm reading a comment here. It's absolutely right. And actually, let's see, Ellie, if you can catch me here. Is it the Eighth Amendment against cruel and unusual punishment? So there is a part of the U.S. Constitution that says the government cannot inflict cruel and unusual punishment against anybody who lives in this country. I would say that that constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. So I really don't want to talk about it today, Charles, if you don't mind. I'm not prepared to. But we're aware of it. And if you live in one of those states where they have this law, let me know and maybe we can find the resources for a lawsuit.
Well, I just can't believe California of all states has it. I have the list right here. California, Florida, Georgia, Iowa, Montana, Oregon, Texas, and Wisconsin. It's unbelievable.
I agree. It's unbelievable. The weird thing about California, I did a Public Records Act request, a whole series of requests, I'd say about 2 years ago, and all the agencies said, we don't do that. And they pointed me to another agency. So the curious thing about this, and you know, I need to redouble my efforts or retriple them or something and try to track this down, because I agree, it's a law that's on the books in California. I don't know if it's ever been enforced, and if so, when, and did, you know, yeah. And folks, a lot of times states have laws on the book that don't get enforced. Believe it or not, I would think I was in grade school when I found out about this. I lived in Texas at the time. And so one of my teachers, you know, in grade school talked about how in Texas it was illegal to have wire cutters in your vehicle or on your horse, by the way. I guess that could be a vehicle. So why? Is because people use wire cutters and cut people's fences wire down. So anyway, I hope that in California this is a law that's not being enforced, but I can't promise it's not. I don't know of anybody who has been involuntarily castrated chemically or otherwise in California. I do know one person who's chosen castration of surgical castration. He chose that for himself. Okay. So, and yeah.
Janice, this is GSH.
Hi, GSH.
Right along the lines of cruel and unusual punishment, there was a recent Michigan Supreme Court decision.
Mm-hmm.
I took interest because that was my state of conviction.
Okay.
And they had a law that criminalized or put some people who had not committed a sexual crime onto the sex offender registry. I'm afraid I don't know all the specifics, but they overturned that law about 3 weeks ago, and it was under the Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment. And that
what state was that again?
That was Michigan. It was very recent, about 3 weeks ago. I did not have the time to follow up, but I think this could possibly be a small inroad into the whole issue of cruel and unusual sex offender registrant.
Okay, thank you, GSH, for that information. I'll look it up. Thank you. Okay, Mark, you have your hand up?
Yes, do you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Are we still on international travel?
I think so.
Okay, yeah.
If you have a question or comment, just go for it.
All right, great. Yeah, I'm getting ready to take a trip. I put in my advance notification. I was requesting for the last, I've been out off parole for 30 years. Over the last quarter century, I've traveled extensively. Europe, as you said, is the only place left, it seems. And I usually go for multiple months. So I always register out and then register back in. I know that some views have changed on whether to do that or not. But I feel most comfortable, and I'm going to give you a reason why. Okay. I was in Rome, Italy in March of 2020.
Okay.
I was meeting my wife there from the Philippines. She came in. The day after she arrived, they started shutting down Rome.
Oh, because of COVID.
It was, the timing was just absolutely perfect. And unfortunately, they were talking about closing off the airport. They were starting to shut down hotels. We had to escape to Switzerland, which was still open at that time. Within one day, they started doing the same things that Rome was doing. So it was a lot of headaches and hassle trying to get things changed out. Okay. I had to get my wife airlines changed first, and then I could start worrying about myself. Once I did that, I was fortunate, actually blessed, to be able to get a flight from Zurich down to Paris and caught the last airplane going to the United States.
Wow.
It had a volunteer crew.
Congratulations.
I was inches close from being stranded and stuck in Europe for a year or whatever it was when there was no flying.
Sure.
Which would have made me, had I not been registered out, that could have created a heck of a problem. Now, I know people would say, well, you've got an excuse. because you were trapped there. I would rather not have to fight that in a court.
I understand.
So my view has always been for all of these years to register out, register back in. Now they don't even want me to come in for the advance notification. They're doing it over phone. I'm in California and took the information. They sent me a copy of the notice that was sent to NTOC or whatever the acronym is. But they said, I do not have to register out. I said, well, I'm leaving for 3 months. He said, well, it's not interrupting. You're going to be back by your birthday. Well, I'm supposed to come back right around the election. Not only am I concerned about what might be happening in the U.S. And elsewhere at that period of time, but we're on the brink of possibly regional or world wars. We already know that airlines and other things can be, the government can force compliance on certain things and airlines shutting down. And so my concern is I want to be able to register out, but they're saying no, that I can't register out.
Who said that?
This was the officer who took the information for the advance notification. But that's because I was coming back before my birthday. My question is, should I make changes to my plans so that they have to register me out? Or do you feel that it is safe to travel under the what this woman, the officer said?
Boy, Mark, you just said a whole lot of things, some of which I don't agree with. I don't think it's unsafe to travel internationally or otherwise. I don't think the election is going to make any difference, no matter who wins or loses. And so as far as registration, folks, the laws are on the books. If you're under International Megan's Law and you go to a registration office to tell them you're traveling overseas, they must accept that. Okay. They are supposed to, that local law enforcement is required by law to notify the federal government if you give them that notice. Now, whether or not they do, it's another matter, but federal law requires them to do that. If I were you, I would go to my registration office. I would take two copies of the document, notifying them of your overseas travel, and say, here it is. I mean, you don't have to ask for permission. You don't have to ask for permission. Do you understand that? To go travel overseas if you're not on parole, probation, or supervised release, which you said you're not. So you go tell your local law enforcement office, here, I'm going overseas. You give them the information. You ask somebody to sign the piece of paper, to sign a copy of this, because you're going to take two copies with you. You ask somebody to do that, even if it's just a duty officer that you were there that day, okay? You're not in control of what the local government does as far as notification to the federal government. That's not your problem. All you are required to do is send that or take that notice to local law enforcement. Is that okay? A clear answer?
The officer I spoke to for the advance notification, when I said that I would come in to register out, she said the Justice Department has notified us that that is not necessary.
Oh, boy. Don't believe him.
Yes, that's why I am very concerned. I'm asking these questions. And the fact that, unfortunately, I was very close to being stranded in Europe.
Okay, that's a long time ago. Let's mark. Come on. That was in 2020. We're in 2024. So we're not going to focus on that. What I'm trying to do is keep you out of trouble now. So yeah. Folks, registration offices do not always have the answers. Now, whether or not they're deliberately misleading you or they're just dumb, I don't know. Okay. But the fact is you protect yourself and you let them worry about themselves. You do what the law requires you to do, which is give this notice at least 21 days before you go overseas and, let the other thing go. And take that piece of paper with you, by the way, when you travel overseas, especially, they're not going to care about when you go to Europe about this, but when you come back to the United States and they want to hassle you about something, go, hey, look at, here it is. Here's my proof. I gave my notice. Okay.
Should I put that on my phone?
Well, you can, but I believe in good old fashioned paper too. Why do I believe in that? Because phones get lost, get stolen. You lose it. The phone battery dies, whatever it is. Right. And I'm the same way. When I board an airplane, I've got my electronic boarding pass. I've got a paper boarding pass, right? I just want to make sure I get on that damn plane. So you can do it the way you want to do it, but that's how I would. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
So I'm getting some other questions over here, so I'm going to try to answer them and try to shift topics. But before I do, here's a couple of commercials, Axol commercials. Okay. Number one, I want to make sure that you know we have a conference And the conference is just next month, about a month from now. So it's on Friday, September 20th, and Saturday, September 21. If you sign up for the conference, notice I'm asking you to sign up for the conference. I'm not asking you to register for the conference. I don't ask anybody to register for anything. I think that's the R word. I don't like it. So anyway, please sign up for the conference. Okay. It only costs $25 and it will give you full access to all the recordings too. Okay. Why are we doing this? Because we have to pay the Zoom people some money so that we can record everything that needs to be recorded and the people who edit our recordings. So thank you for putting me on there. September 20th and September 21 starts at 9 o'clock in the morning, both days, ends at 5 o'clock. You will see me throughout the conference, okay, introducing people. And at the end, I'm going to give my I Have a Dream speech, by the way, just in case you're interested. We have a lot of speakers at the conference, fabulous people who have really important information to share. I mean, you know, when Ellie and I, or Ellie and Jeff and I, or whoever, you know, Axol is here, we have like 2 hours, right? But the conference is lasting 2 days. You're going to learn so much in that 2 day period. Please sign up for the conference. It's a virtual only. Did I mention that? It's only virtual this year. We hope to be back in person next year. This year, it's virtual only. And so, and you can kind of, you know, listen to the conference at your pace. You can go grocery shopping if you need to while, you know, put your earbuds in, please. Because not everybody at the grocery store needs to hear it. However you want to attend the conference. So please sign up as soon as you can. It's a month away. Number two, March 5th of next year. Yes, I'm talking about 2025. So March 5th of next year, please come join us in Washington, D.C. if you are able to. We are going to be in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. Again, this will be the third time we have a vigil in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, and we are there to protest, in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court decision of Smith versus Doe. And I am there personally to egg on John Roberts, who was the attorney who said something so stupid that I just need to remind him every year of this, which is he said that the requirement to register is similar to applying for membership at Price Club. Now, if that doesn't make you crazy, I don't know what will. It's like, really? And since when does Price Club tell you you can't, you know, you can't leave their membership? You can't basically terminate your membership, right? So, but that's what he said. And he needs to be reminded that he said something stupid and that now that he's the Chief Justice, guess what? He can clean up his own mistake. So that's March 5th of next year. The third commercial is this. Folks, Axol basically operates on funding that people like you provide to the organization. Nobody wants to give us a grant, I'm sorry to say, but if you would be so kind as to consider making a donation to Axol, we would be very, very happy about that. And the more important thing about that is we can do more work. So the more work we do depends on the donations that we get. And there's going to be a huge effort. It's actually started, but it's behind the scenes right now. So when it comes to improving the tiered registry law here in California, major effort. We're throwing every resource we have at this next year. Okay, this year, it wasn't possible. It's a presidential election year. And state legislators, I swear, sometimes they can find their backbone. Most of the time, they can't. But certainly in presidential election years, I refer to them as jellyfish. They don't make any difficult decisions in presidential election years like this year. So what we're doing is we're preparing. We've already started the preparations to, in fact, lobby our state legislature next year. We need to significantly increase the number of people who are eligible to petition. We're at 45% now. That's not nearly enough. And we want to add huge categories of people to make them eligible to petition for removal. Nobody is automatically eligible. Everybody has to file a petition. But my current situation, and I've been doing this now since July of 2021, so for 3 years, I've gotten 105 people off the registry so far. There's been more than 7,000 petitions filed so far statewide. You know, we need to get everybody off the freaking registry. I will do it any way possible. And this is a great way, I think. This is a great way to get it done. So we, as I said earlier, and it bears repeating, Axol has, for the very first time in our existence, 14 years of existence, we have hired a professional lobbyist because this is something that is so darn important that we need somebody who can help us navigate through the system, starting with, get this, we need a sponsor for the bill and we need an author for the bill. Okay, a sponsor and an author. Oh, by the way, if you happen to know somebody who would like to sponsor or author the bill, please share that information with me. But chances are you don't. I don't. And I'm here in Sacramento. And by the way, of course, there'll be a changing of the decks on the chairs on the deck of the Titanic, or however you look at it right here in the state legislature. Some people will not win elections. Some people will term out. In other words, we will have a lot of new legislators in early next year, actually late this year in November. So he can help us navigate through that path. We've never done this before. We're still nervous about signing a contract with him. And we did it knowing that we could basically fire him with 30 days notice if necessary. But the money that you provide for that purpose, there's a matching grant program that we have right now. So we have a member who donated $10,000 for a matching grant program. Yeah, wow, grants in there. Yeah, it's awesome. And he said, look, every dollar that you bring in this matching grant program, I will match. So hopefully we can get up to $20,000 up. So anyway, please consider donating. Any amount is welcome, welcome, welcome. And again, it basically adds, gives us resources so we can file more lawsuits, because I love to file lawsuits. Okay, I actually don't. But you know what? When they're so stupid, they do stupid things, number one. And number two, they don't fix what they've stupid things they've done, then they need to bear the consequences here. Okay, Magic Grant Program. Thank you, Dave. So let's talk about categories of people. And by the way, this is phenomenal. We actually have our Sex Offender Management Board agreeing with us that the tiered registry law needs to be fixed. Okay, this is huge. Okay, that CASOM, thank you, was in fact created for the purpose of making recommendations to the state legislature. And guess what? They've already done that in writing. I mean, you know, think about it. It's one thing to say it during a meeting, but it's a whole other thing for them to put it in writing. They've done it in writing. They've sent their recommendations to the state legislature. But you know what happens when they send their recommendations? They go on somebody's desk. You know, they go, yeah, I mean to read that report someday, but I'm not reading it today. What the board cannot do is actively lobby. We can lobby. We are a 501c4 under the IRS code for anybody else out there who, in fact, is an expert on the IRS code. And we choose to be a 501c4 so that we can do advocacy. It's extremely important. Nobody else is doing this. So you have to understand that. Okay. So here are the categories. People convicted of felony possession of child pornography. Okay. If it's a felony possession of child pornography, you're right now on tier 3, which is the highest tier. Makes no sense to me. This is a non-contact, non-violent offense. And why in the heck are you on tier 3, which, by the way, still requires lifetime registration? Okay. So number two. People convicted of Penal Code Section 288, Subsection C. It's lewd or lascivious acts with somebody who's 14 or 15. Tier 3, highest tier. What? How come somebody with a younger victim is on Tier 2 and you're putting this group of people on Tier 3? Okay, so that's done. I say it's done, but it's not really. So we agree with this CASOM, or CASOM agrees with us, that these categories of people do not belong on the highest tier of the tiered registry. Okay, now we keep going. 288.2, 288.3, and 288.4. They're all similar offenses, and a lot of them involve sting operations. And ASOM is saying, nope, they do not belong on Tier 3. In fact, we think they belong on Tier 1. And by the way, that is their solution, too, for people convicted of felony possession of child pornography. Okay? So that's what CASOM agrees with us about. And then we want to go at least one step further. We want to take everybody who's assigned to Tier 3 and give you an off-ramp where at some point in time you will be eligible to petition for removal. At this point in time, we think the only thing we can get away with is a 30-year period. I apologize for that, but if it's 10 years, 20 years, unfortunately, the next answer is 30. Okay. So the CASOM said they weren't ready to approve that or make that recommendation yet. They're chewing on it. They don't want everybody who's on Tier 3 to have that off ramp. We do, by the way. We believe everybody after 30 years should, in fact, be able to petition. But anyway, we don't have their support yet, but we're still working. Okay. Will, you have your hand up?
Yeah. Hi. Thank you. I am on Tier 3 because of the felony possession, but my case was just expunged. And much to my surprise, that does not matter under 1203.
It does not.
That just seems like a violation of procedural due process. Like, how can I can't appeal it. It is what it is forever.
Yes. However, some people, not everyone, but some people convicted of felony CP possession in state court, they can go and get a reduction. So talk to a lawyer, not me. Maybe Ellie can answer that question. question for you offline. We don't want to do this on a recorded call. But you, if you're eligible to have your felony reduced to misdemeanor, you will drop from tier 3, the highest tier, to tier 1, the lowest tier.
But my felony was actually expunged.
It doesn't make any difference.
Oh, it still needs to be reclassified. Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
You can reclassify even if it's been expunged.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's, you know, it's just the way the laws will. I'm not saying I agree with it, but that's the way the laws written.
Alternatively, we chatted on the phone once. I'm starting my third year of law school, and I'm going to be doing some study on sex offender registration laws and the constitutionality, all of that. So I'd love to, I'll send an email and maybe you can give me some direction.
Oh, I'd love to talk to you about it. Yeah, absolutely. And folks, for some of you who don't know, my assistant is somebody who's on the registry, my legal assistant, and he lost his license when he was convicted of a sex offense. And guess what his offense was? Possession of child pornography. So trust me, I'm working very hard for him and for everybody who's in that category, because it makes no sense whatsoever. And this is a weird thing that it used to be. I very rarely agree with the federal government about anything. I even more rarely point to them as a good example. But when it comes to felony possession of child pornography, they actually think that it should be a tier 1 offense. So I am using that as one of the arguments. So it's always interesting. It's like politics makes strange bedfellows. And this is an example of that. So anyway, I point to them as an example. Okay. So we will have Lobby Day next year. I'm anticipating Lobby Day will be in early February of next year. You will have the opportunity to come to Sacramento and tell those legislators and their staff exactly why they should be improving the tiered registry law. So please, please, please consider doing that again February. If you're not able to travel for whatever reason, then we are going to be asking you to make phone calls and send letters. So we're not there yet, folks. Don't ask me what to do today, because I don't have anything for you to do today. We have to wait. In California, we're finishing a 2-year. Jay Lee, would you please mute yourself for some? Thank you. For some reason I couldn't do that. So this is the end of a 2-year legislative session, actually next month in September. And so then what happens, the election in November, and then the another 2-year session starts in January next year. So it has to be, you know, we have to fit within their legislative schedule. They're not changing their legislative schedule for us, trust me. Whether that's good or bad, they're not going. Okay, so Dave, I'm not sure how to raise my hand. Dave.
Hi. So I have the attempt. I have the attempt to receive. Can you tell me what the update is on that?
Absolutely. So this is example of successful litigation. Department of Justice here in California was basically putting people who were convicted of an attempted offense on the same tier as if they had completed the offense. Okay. And we said, wrong. That's not what you're supposed to do. And they said, well, that's what we're doing. And they didn't say sue us, but we did. We sued them anyway. So we took California DOJ to court, and the judge agreed with us that not every attempted offense belongs on the same tier. No attempted offense belongs on the same tier as a completed offense. Okay. So we have a settlement agreement with California DOJ that basically says that they will not assign people convicted of an attempted offense to the same tier as a completed offense, with a few exceptions. And the only reason there are exceptions is because the law states that there are these exceptions. So unfortunately, people convicted of attempted 288A, lewd or lascivious acts with somebody under the age of 14, whether it's completed or attempted, that's still tier 2. But for many people, we can take you from the tier 3 down to tier 1, okay? And so it's really worthwhile to have somebody make that request on your behalf. I'm willing to do it. Other attorneys are willing to do it. Unfortunately, the DOJ has not created a system for doing this, right? And it's like, well, shouldn't there be a form to fill out or something like that? Unfortunately, there's not. So you probably need a lawyer to send a letter on your behalf. But that's the...
So it's not going to happen as an operation of law. They're not going to do that. It's just send them a request citing this this agreement. I read the agreement, so.
Yeah. Well, the agreement's online. So, yeah. So, I mean, it's really good news, even though it took a lawsuit and a judge to kick him in the fanny to get him to that point. But yes, for most people who were convicted of an attempted offense, and folks, it's not the same as being convicted of something with intent to commit a sex offense. That's different. It has to be, is it 667 LA Penal Code Section 667 is an attempt?
664.
664, thank you. Me and numbers don't always agree. So Penal Code Section 664/something, that is an attempt. Okay. So if you think that you qualify there, please contact me and and you know, I can give you some advice about how to go forward. Yeah, mm-hmm. Thank you, Dave, for your question.
No problem.
Okay. So let me talk about another lawsuit where we prevailed, and that has to do with treatment. So people who are living here in California and on parole, you're going to benefit from this lawsuit that we filed, the results of the lawsuit. So it turns out that Department of Corrections, a state agency, was breaking the law. They do that from time to time, and we catch them some of the time anyway. So they what they were doing here was they had a policy that basically said that every registrant, the entire time they're on parole, had to undergo treatment. Now, that's bad enough. So sometimes it means you have to go to a weekly meeting for a couple of hours, maybe during when you should be working or that. That's bad enough. But what was even worse is that then the people who were on the street and on parole were being denied early discharge from parole because, quote, you're undergoing treatment. Now, think about that. So CDCR is requiring people to undergo treatment, and then the Bureau is basically telling people you won't get early discharge because you're undergoing treatment. So that's what the state law says, and it's the same state law, by the way. The state law says you have to, if you're a registrant and you're on parole, you have to complete at least 1 year of treatment. It says a minimum of 1 year, okay? After that 1 year, then what's supposed to happen and what's going to happen now because of the settlement agreement is that your treatment provider and your parole officer are supposed to make a formal determination after 1 year about whether or not your additional treatment is required. Okay. And guess what? Then as soon as the regulations get issued, which should be next month in September, that as soon as that happens, then the decision gets made, it's put in writing, and you are handed a copy of the decision. That's never happened, okay? That is so important because just in case they make a stupid decision about whether or not further treatment is required, you can sue them in court, okay? And I'm sure a lot of attorneys will be doing this, but that piece of paper will be very important. Now, having said that, if you have, been on parole for 1 year and you have 3 violations of parole, it's not going to happen. If they say you have to undergo more treatment, I would agree, okay? 3 parole violations in the first year. So it has to be unreasonable decision, okay? But I got contacted by somebody this week who's been on parole for 6.5 years. I believe it's 6.5 years. He's been undergoing treatment this whole time, and the new treatment provider basically said he has to start all over again. So we're going to see if we can get that corrected. That's utter nonsense, right? And it's against the law. No. And then I've had some people tell me that there's a treatment company out there whose name is Sharp Future, is telling the parolees in Riverside County that they're going to have to go through a minimum of 3 years of treatment, to which I say bullshit. That is not what the settlement agreement says. And if they ever do that, then we're going to sue them. Okay. And so in this case, supposedly the treatment provider is pointing to CDCR saying, oh, CDCR says that's okay, or maybe even required. No, it's supposed to be a case by case decision. So individual by individual, whether or not additional treatment's required. Okay. And if they make the wrong decision, then you can go to court because the third part of that state law that's still in existence says, and a superior court judge can terminate treatment at any time. And I had a case here in California in a county, San Mateo County, I recall, in San Mateo County, where the judge did just that. And the, this poor man, he completed treatment. He had a certificate of completion, which, by the way, the treatment provider wouldn't give him, but he was told he had a certificate of completion. And yet they were requiring him to start all over again in the program. And she said, nope. And it was a beautiful thing to see. And the guillotine came down, boom, and that superior court judge said, no more treatment. And that was that. Okay. And so guess what? He's never gotten another day of treatment. So, it's like, folks, we can do this the easy way or we can do this the hard way. So we have a settlement agreement that has the provisions that I just told you. Now, supposedly it's done every year. I don't know when that year starts. I expect on your anniversary of when you started parole, but I'm not absolutely sure of that. Okay. And so it's going to have, a rolling effect here that everybody, they can't evaluate everybody at the exact same time and stuff. So I think it's going to happen on the anniversary of your parole date. Regulations are supposed to be issued next month. Okay. And we're going to scrutinize those regulations. And if they have it wrong, we'll be back and forth. But right now we're giving them the benefit of the doubt that they said they would issue these regulations and that the regulations will in fact be consistent with the settlement agreement that they signed. So does anybody have questions about treatment? Hands up?
I do.
Okay.
Does that apply? So federal convictions, those that are in treatment for federal convictions, or is it only state?
It's at this point, Dave, it's only state, but okay. I'd be happy to talk to you offline like next week. Let's talk because I don't know what federal law says about this, that what I've been quoting is a state law. So that doesn't apply to federal.
And it would be interesting because I go to treatment with both state and federal. So all the state people get out, but the federal have to stay in. You know, that would be kind of weird.
Oh, that would be very strange, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you. Yeah.
I'd be happy to talk to you about it.
Janice, yes. will this impact the probation as well as the parole? Also, will that impact the polygraph, which is tied to the programs?
Okay. When people ask me compound questions like that, I have a tendency to forget them all, but let me try. Okay, so it will not affect people on probation because this is a law that affects parolees only. But again, if you're on probation, call me and let's look at what the state law says. I don't know. And so I'm sorry, what was your other question?
Polygraphs are attached to the treatment programs.
Yes, you'll still have to go through, still have to undergo polygraphs, but it's possible, Mr. Barton, that you would only have to do one, okay, or maybe two, and that within the 1 year, and then it would stop after that. So again, it has to do with them making a decision. And again, your parole officer is supposed to be talking to your treatment provider. That's what's supposed to happen. They're supposed to make a joint decision about whether or not additional treatment is required, okay? And they have to put that decision in writing, and they have to give you a copy of it. All these components are extremely important because, you know what, as I said, and I mean it, if they make a stupid decision, then we're going to sue the bastards, okay? I mean, what else can we do? And you do it under writ of habeas corpus, and you say, look, judge, this person should not be undergoing treatment anymore. And hopefully, you know, we'll have a judge with backbone like the one in San Mateo County. And as I said, it was a guillotine coming down. I've never been so happy. I've never been so happy. Yeah, because CDCR had an illegal, unlawful policy, and they got caught. And so that was a good thing. They agreed to correct their ways. Does anybody else have any questions about that before? Michael, your hand's up. Yes, sir.
I realize I'm in a bit of a unique situation, but I'm okay. On parole from California. I live in Minnesota. I'm in a treatment program. I will probably be released from that treatment program at the end of 1 year in Minnesota. Okay. Will that then have any traction with California and possibly an early discharge after I hit 3 year mark?
So, Michael, I'm assuming that you're in the other state under an interstate compact.
Yes.
I don't like interstate compacts. and I mean, in general, and the reason I say that is because when you're on an interstate compact, you have the worst of both worlds. So you have all the regulations of the sending state and all the and laws of the receiving state. I don't have a precise answer to your question, Michael. I just don't know. But okay. But thank you for giving me something to think about. Thank you.
Thank you, Janice.
You're welcome. Any other questions or comments about treatment here? Okay. I'm looking here. Is 288.3A a tier 3 offense? I believe it is. I think all of 288.3 is a tier 3 offense right now. It is something, though, it's a recommendation of the Sex Offender Management Board, as well as a request from Axel that 288.3 be lowered from tier 3, the highest tier, requiring lifetime registration, to tier 1, which would require 10 years of registration. And for anybody who's listening to this or on the call today, if you're wondering, well, when does my registration period begin? The registration period begins when you get out of custody. So if you've been to jail or you've been to prison, it starts the day after you get out of jail or prison. If you're lucky enough not to have spent time in jail or prison, like you just went and got booked and all that, it's the next day after you're booked. And Jay Lee, you have your hand up.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hi. Okay, so with the California, the tier 3 registry, is there two different like areas of that, like a gray area, depending on the risk level and then also just lifetime and like no questions asked? Is there like wiggle room with that? How do you find out about that?
Okay, you've asked an important question. So some people are assigned to tier 3 based on risk level and not their offense. And when you get your tier assignment letter, it will say that. So it's funny, like during about the first top of the top half of the page, the tier assignment letter, it will say tier 3 dash risk level. Okay. Mm-hmm. If you are tier 3 based on risk level, you can petition after 20 years. That's the exception to the rule. In the law, we always have exceptions. It keeps us attorneys busy. So anyway, if your loved one is on their tier assigned to tier 3 solely based on risk level, then in fact, he or she can apply after 20 years.
Apply And where would you apply for the petition? Is that like the whole governor petition, that whole process that you would go through?
Okay. Thank you for asking about the governor. So we were actually asked by somebody in the governor's office to send out a notice about the following. Okay. Governors do not pardon people on the sex offender registry, number one. And number two, if they did, it wouldn't terminate your requirement to register. Okay. Unfortunately, some people are paying attorneys a lot of money to do that. Okay. And the governor's office, I guess, is getting upset or frustrated with or being buried by applications for governor's pardon from people on their registry. The governor's office doesn't want to see them anymore because they know that you're not going to get the relief that you're looking for. Okay.
Okay.
As far as the petitioning process goes, folks, you petition, you file your petition in the county where you currently reside. Okay. Is that clear? Where the county where you currently reside is where you file the petition. Now, later you'll serve the petition on both the county where you currently reside, the DA in the county where you currently reside, as well as the DA in the county where you're convicted, if those things are different. Now, the thing is, like, I helped somebody recently and he was convicted and he currently resides in the same county, happens to be Los Angeles County, though it was in different cities, but that doesn't make a difference because the DA represents the whole county, okay? So it has to do with who gets served, not where you file it. So wherever the person resides, that the county, that's where you file it,
the petition. Start the petition. Okay, great. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Apple 2, you got your hand up.
Hey, Janice, sorry I don't have my name on there.
It's okay.
Yeah, so about the polygraphs, I know when I stopped doing the treatment, they haven't made me do those anymore. So I don't know if it could just be a contract, like they're figuring out how to do it, or if they're just going to skip the polygraph altogether.
Well, you know, I'm happy for you. And I hope the same thing happens for other people, but I can't guarantee it. I think we're going to get more details. We will get more details when these regulations are issued.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Right. Lower hand. Okay. So I don't have a lot more topics to discuss today. I don't have a lot more energy to talk about them anyway. I think I've covered the biggest topics here. I'm really grateful that you all are here today. I look forward to talking to you next month. Every month we have updates, things, cases that come out. Hopefully we might have the regulations from the CDCR here about treatment. Wouldn't that be great? So we can actually talk about it. I'm going to take a quick look at the calendar here. I want to make sure I got the date for next month, which is going to be important. The 21st of September is our next Zoom meeting. This is a great way for us to share information with you. It's a good way for you to share information with us too, because guess what? Things are changing at a fairly rapid pace, and it's only going to get more rapid, I predict. I hope that you will, in fact, consider making a donation to AXOL. It's easy to do on our website, or you can send a check the old-fashioned way to the Alliance. Maybe Dave or somebody, Ellie, could put the address, the street address for the organization, and such. Checks are we're happy to get a check. And by the way, we do get donations from $5 to, the gentleman who just donated $10,000. We don't get $10,000 checks very often, so we thank his first name is Cliff. We thank him for that, and he knew what he was doing, and we talked about it, and as far as a matching grant program, so it's very valuable that way. And I see one more hand up, Lou. You got a question here or a comment?
Yes, quickly. Thank you, Attorney Bellucci. The provider that I'm involved with does a program that requires you to go through the steps, and when you're done, rather than give you a certificate of completion, they put you on what they call maintenance, where you just have to show up once a month as a follow-up. I guess it's kind of a double check to make sure that you're not going in the wrong direction. Since I have completed the program, is there anyone else that's in a program that gets put into a maintenance level so yes. that they can continue the treatment, and that's part of the treatment, or is it in excess of the treatment?
Well, maintenance is considered a part of treatment, but I would think that, Lou, that, they have to have a justification to continue you in treatment, no matter what level of treatment it is. So that is something I think that could be subject to judicial review if, in fact, you think that, that you don't belong there.
So would it be wrong for me to request in writing a certificate of completion?
Oh, I'd love for you to do that and let me know the results. I don't know why they play. It's like the shell game, the nut game with the pea underneath the walnut shell. Why they think that they can't give a certificate of completion to somebody on the registry. Oh, by the way, it's your certificate, right? But that was one of the games that they were playing in the San Mateo case, that they told the man verbally that he had a certificate of completion, and then they refused to give him a copy of it. But guess what? When we sued them, we got a copy of it.
Okay. Thank you for that. I will follow up on that. And thank you for doing this today.
You're very welcome. And thank you all, everybody, and I look forward to seeing you in September. Take good care. Bye-bye.